Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 688, Darkness in the Vault. This program is being recorded on September 6th of the year 2009. We're going to plunge right in and begin with the story of what happened to the heirs, or the efforts of the heirs, of Severino Jesus Garcia de Santa Romana, the OSS agent who was in charge of many of the Golden Lily accounts that were utilized by U.S. intelligence and also elements of U.S. and international power structure for slush funds, covert operations, and a variety of purposes. And we're going to, if people want to know how the system works, watch this, because this is how the system works. And inside of those vaults is a lot of darkness indeed. And as economic reform and as the attempts at controlling those institutions deemed too big to fail, grind onward, remember that what lies in those vaults is very dark indeed, and it's one of the reasons why I personally am not optimistic about the prospects for serious financial reform, as important as though that is. Talking now about what happened to the heirs of Severino Santa Romana when they went to try to reclaim some $50 billion that was rightfully his. We're reading now from the book Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. This was authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, published in hard and soft cover by Verso Books. And of the unsuccessful efforts of Santi's heirs, a truly enlightening and terrifying tale, we read, when he died, Santi left to 14 heirs a fortune estimated by their attorneys to be worth over $50 billion. All their efforts to recover his assets from banks have been blocked or, more often, evaded. The three main heirs were Santi's corporate accountant, Tarciana Rodriguez, acting for the estate, his common-law wife, Lutz Rambano, and his adult daughter, Flor Elisa. After a few false starts, they turned for help to the famous San Francisco lawyer Melvin Belli, New York attorney Eleanor Jackson Peel, former CIA Deputy Director Ray Klein, and one of America's best-known bankers, Citibank CEO John Reed. Also engaged in these efforts were Florida lobbyist George DePontis, former Bahamas Supreme Court Justice Sir Leonard Knowles, and Washington attorney Robert A. Ackerman. Because of the size of Santi's estate and its secretive nature, Lutz, Tarciana, and Florida Lisa seem to have had every conceivable obstacle put in their path. The U.S. government and American banks would like Santi's assets to remain where they are. So would the Swiss government and Swiss banks, banks in Hong Kong, and in other financial centers. In a few more years, everybody connected to Santi will be dead, so custody of his cash and bullion will remain in the banks, much like Holocaust gold. For Washington, stonewalling is imperative not only because of the gigantic assets involved, but to block attorneys from pursuing discovery, as in the Schley case, which could reveal far more than Santi's financial data. Potentially, discovery could result in disclosure of the whole subject of covert war gold recoveries, the Black Eagle Trust, diversion to corrupt purposes of secret funds like the M Fund. This could damage reputations and careers and make unavoidable an investigation by the General Accounting Office of Congress. President Ford had addressed a similar problem in 1975 when he set up the Rockefeller Commission to pacify interest in the CIA family jewels affair, remarking that he did not want information getting out that could blacken the reputation of every U.S. president since Truman. Ironically, Santi's heirs were only interested in ending their poverty, not in exposing corruption, so it would have made sense to placate them with generous settlements in return for signed agreements never to raise the matter again. Yet both banks and governments have remained doggedly opaque and obstinate in blocking the heirs, a sure sign that they have much to hide. Although the three principal heirs showed these banks probated wills, passbooks, bank statements, receipts, all the necessary passwords, code words, and secret account numbers provided to them by Santi, the response was the same. With four exceptions, the banks flatly denied having such accounts, whether the account in question was a safe deposit box or a huge gold bullion deposit. For example, According to the Union Bank Suisse documents reproduced on our data CDs, Santee's biggest single account there was 20,000 metric tons of gold bullion. This is the account on which the title holder was magically changed at the moment of Santee's death from Santee's Crown Commodity Holdings to Major General Edward G. Lansdale, bearing in mind that spelling errors made by Swiss banks are part of deliberate authenticity codes. By the way, Lansdale is spelled here L-A-N-D-S-D-A-L-E. His actual name was spelled L-A-N-S-D-A-L-E. There was only one D. But as noted here by the Seagraves, the deliberate misspellings here are done by Swiss banks in order to show that, basically in order to specialize their secret accounts. Only people with those incorrect spellings are able to access these accounts. Continuing. One possibility is that on this monster account, Santee was merely a straw man being replaced by another straw man, Lansdale. We might ask, who else but a government would have sufficient leverage to make such a change at the biggest bank in Switzerland? Had UBS alone made the change, they are unlikely to have chosen the eccentric Lansdale as the new title holder. However, by 1974, Lansdale had been out of government for a decade, and was one of the founding fathers of the Enterprise Network and an intimate colleague of some of America's wealthiest conservative moguls. Of course, the Enterprise Network was utilized by Oliver North and Company for many of the Iran-Contra-related machinations. Continuing, if Lansdale and Santee always had shared control of this big UBS account, Lansdale might have been able to have UBS transfer title to his name, whereafter it could be accessed by his circle. The U.S. government may not have been involved at all. At $300 an ounce, this account would be worth $192 billion, a lot more than the net worth of Bill Gates. Is this some believable? Of course, let me interrupt here. That's when gold was $300 an ounce. It's now pushing $1,000 an ounce. So just imagine the stakes that are literally at stake here. Just imagine the wealth that is at stake with regard to these various secret gold repositories and related accounts and financial instruments. Beginning this paragraph again, at $300 an ounce, this account would be worth $192 billion, a lot more than the net worth of Bill Gates. Is this sum believable? Yes, if it is a covert U.S. government account containing a mass of black gold. Just as no serious counterfeiter makes silly spelling mistakes, no con man in his right mind would dream up an account so big. Recall that the jury in the Rojas Gold Buddha case saw convincing evidence that $1.63 trillion in gold was sold by Marcos through his Australian brokers. Documents we produce on our data CDs bearing the signatures of a number of top Swiss bankers show that UBS has other accounts, including gold bullion and platinum, which are even larger. Such giant accounts are not out of the question for immensely wealthy men like King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, whose family have been banking bullion in Switzerland for decades. According to Gemini Consulting, worldwide private bank assets were $4.3 trillion in 1986 and were closing in on $14 trillion in 2000. So this account at UBS is not impossible. UBS documents show that Crown Commodity Holdings was a subsidiary of Santee's Crown Enterprises. The group representative was Alfredo P. Ramos, an executive of Santee's company Diaz and Porati Enterprises, registered in Monaco. Ramos states in an affidavit that, quote, I know the late Don Severino Garcia Santa Romana, Ramon Perotti, or Jose Antonio Diaz under the code From Father, My Old Man, that once the work has begun, don't leave until it's done, be the labor great or small, do it well or not at all, unquote. This homily, as we've seen, is one that Santee learned from 1945. It is the same homily Santee quoted in his holographic will. It is used as a code phrase consistently in Santee's bank accounts. Such recurrences, over half a century, are not accidental. According to videotaped interviews with Tarsiana, immediately after Santee's death, Lansdale also was involved in the mysterious movement of gold bullion from Santee's accounts at Citibank Manila to Citibank New York, possibly done to get the assets out of the Philippines before Marcos could attach them. Because the accounts were in Santi's names, such transfers would appear to be illegal without authorization from a recognized trustee of his estate or someone holding his power of attorney, such as Chief Accountant Tarciana. If Lansdale had such a power of attorney, for whom was Lansdale acting? Once these assets left the Philippines, they joined other bullion and cash accounts that documents show Santi already had in America at Citibank, Chase, Wells Fargo, Hanover Bank, and other banks as well. Soon after his death, Santi's holographic will was probated in Manila, and Tarciana Luce and Fortaleza were named by the court as legitimate heirs. Luce went to America, hoping to gain access to the accounts at Citibank in Manhattan. There, she enlisted the help of attorney Eleanor Jackson Peel, giving her letters of administration issued by the Philippine court. These had to be recognized by New York courts. Peel proceeded in surrogates court for the issuance of ancillary letters of administration, which would give Lutz right of access to his accounts at Citibank, Chase, and Hanover. This took time. While Lutz pressed her case elsewhere, Peel wrote letters to the head offices of all the banks concerned, asking about the Santa Romana accounts. Not a single bank replied to the letters. Luce then flew to Switzerland, visiting UBS in Geneva with two American friends. According to one of the Americans, Jim Brown, quote, "I sat with Luce and another American while she gave a vice president of Union Bank Suisse Santi's Master Gold account number with them, Master Gold account 7257. This banker not only admitted that it was a correct account, but also said he was familiar with the account," unquote. Brown insists that the bank vice president then told Lutz, quote, "he wouldn't recommend her trying to claim this account while she was in Switzerland, because before the bank or even the government of Switzerland would agree to allow her to take what this account represented, they would not be beyond having her killed first." This last sentence again. Brown insists that the bank vice president then told Lutz, quote, "he wouldn't recommend her trying to claim this account while she was in Switzerland, because before the bank or even the government of Switzerland would agree to allow her to take what this account represented, they," meaning the bank and the Swiss government, "would not be beyond having her killed first." He also went on to tell her that he wouldn't recommend her hiring any Swiss attorneys, because the bank would simply buy them off, unquote. We might scoff at the notion that a UBS vice president would make murder threats, but what of Christoph Miley? A student working nights as a security guard at UBS in Zurich in January 1997, he discovered very old documents and books waiting to be shredded. They concerned assets of depositors who died in Nazi death camps. He knew that a few months earlier the Swiss government had ordered banks not to destroy archival material. He took some documents and gave them to the Hebrew congregation of Zurich. When asked later why he did it, Miley replied that he had recently seen the movie Schindler's List. "I knew I had to do something," unquote. A month later, when the documents were made public by others, Miley was fired from his $18,000 job at UBS. Robert Studer, president of UBS, insinuated that Miley was financed by an international Jewish conspiracy. Quote, "This issue of so-called unclaimed Jewish money in Swiss banks rears its head again and again. For us, it is no issue at all. The problem was thoroughly discussed after the Second World War, and we conscientiously investigated then what money in our bank might have belonged to Holocaust victims, because we wanted to settle the question once and for all. For us, the case is closed," unquote. Much as the State Department insists that the 1951 San Francisco Peace Treaty closed the door on compensation and reparations for Japan's war victims, much as Washington and the Marcoses insisted that the Yamashita Gold story was only a myth, UBS passed off the shredder incident as unfortunate, saying, "no one in our senior management would ever have approved such a decision," unquote. Robert Studer was removed from all official duties, but remained the bank's honorary chairman. Christoph Miley received over 100 death threats and threats to his wife and children. They fled to America, where they were given asylum. Miley testified before U.S. congressional committees investigating the hiding of Nazi assets by Swiss banks. Senator Anthony D'Amato called Christoph Miley an international hero. The criminals are the ones who ordered the shredding of the documents, unquote. Scared and deflated, Lutz returned to the Philippines. 3 years later, she and Brown went back to Switzerland to approach a different bank. This time, Brown told us they were successful in recovering the accumulated interest from one of Santi's accounts, but the bank would not release the bullion itself. Another source told us Lutz kept this recovery secret, feeling that she had been stonewalled so long that it would be absurd to forfeit any of it in taxes. Meanwhile, Tatiana, Santi's corporate treasurer, tried to access his accounts at HSBC in Hong Kong. Following the advice of attorney Artemio Dobrin, who had been Santi's tax consultant, she asked HSBC to verify the existence of the accounts mentioned in Santi's holographic will. After showing them all the necessary codes, passwords, and documents, a bank officer told her the accounts had not matured and therefore were inaccessible, and that they should come back in 1988. In turn, Flordelisa sought access to Santi's accounts at the Hong Kong branch of Sanwa Bank. She had a passbook showing large cash deposits to that branch in March of 1973. At first, Sanwa denied it had a branch in Hong Kong in 1973. Then, despite all the documentation, they claimed they had no client called Santa Romana or any of his many pseudonyms. When Cory Aquino became president, her staff asked Australian financial expert Peter Nelson for help. He was shown computer sheets and 40 passports bearing Santi's photo. Quote, "The passports matched details on the numerous bank accounts. Most transfers had originated in Hong Kong before being moved to other parts of the world. I added up the amounts mentally as I went along and lost count at around $40 billion. I was shown photos of crates, and some of these were open. I, of course, could not vouch for this bullion, but there were certificates to match," unquote. The Aquino aides explained that Santi had left the majority of his estate to his daughter, which would make Flordelisa one of the richest women on earth. But when she tried to present the probated will to banks, she was told to prove that the man in the photo on all the passports with all the different names was, in fact, her father. Meanwhile, the banks would sit profitably on the money. Nelson said, quote, "I told my Filipino friends there was a way out. If Flordelisa agreed to hand the money back to the government of the Philippines for a finder's fee of, say, 5%, that would give her more money than she could spend in a lifetime, and the government would lend their weight in pushing for its return. They thanked me, and I flew back to Sydney," unquote. Nothing came of it, and Flordelisa stayed poor. Ultimately, all efforts fixed on Citibank, where John Reed was chairman and CEO. Under Reed's direction, Citibank became richly involved in offshore private banking. With offshore deposits worth over $100 billion, it was ranked third after UBS with $580 billion and Credit Suisse with $292 billion. By shifting money from country to country, offshore assets are protected from litigation by creditors, ex-spouses, or heirs. Except for cases involving money laundering, securities fraud, or narcotics, most foreign courts will not recognize a U.S. court order. So a claimant must fight for access through courts in the nation where the account is held, only to discover the money already had been moved to another jurisdiction. This is key to what follows. In December of 1990, Tarsiana went to Citibank's head office in Manhattan with a friend acting as financial advisor and witness. "We were taken in to see John Reed himself," her friend said. "When we showed him our documents, passwords, and code phrases, the magnitude of it suddenly hit Reed. He went white and panicked. You could see it in his face. He left the conference room in a hurry. A few minutes later, he returned with several Citibank lawyers," unquote. They told Tarsiana to come back the following day. When we walked into the conference room the next day, Tarsiana's friend recounted, "We found Reed sitting there with 20 lawyers. They told us these accounts did not exist," unquote. Again, Tarsiana and her friend went away. On inspiration, they flew to Albany, where they visited the New York State Tax Office. In its public records archive, they obtained a list of all the accounts Santee had at Citibank and other banks in New York State under his own name and his aliases and his company names, reproduced on our data CDs. They also discovered that all state and federal taxes had been waived on interest generated by these very big accounts, a curious exemption. Returning to Citibank, they were confronted once again by Reed and his phalanx of attorneys. Tarsiana and her friend showed them a copy of the New York State tax records list demonstrating that the bank had lied and the accounts did in fact exist. According to Santee's own records and documents Tarsiana had with her, Citibank held 4,700 metric tons of gold bullion belonging to Santee's estate. No longer denying they had the accounts, the attorneys blandly told the two women to bring in the real party, unquote. They refused to identify whom they meant, possibly Santee's corpse. They also said Tarsiana needed legal, unquote, papers, which she had already showed them. They said Citibank wanted a statement from the Philippine government that it would not hold them responsible for releasing the money, again, implicitly acknowledging the bank did, in fact, hold the assets. This inferred that the funds might be claimed by Manila as stolen gold by Marcos, though the accounts were set up by Santee long before Marcos came to power. The attorneys also said they wanted a waiver from Imelda Marcos, implying that the Marcos family might make claims real or imaginary to some of Santee's assets. Finally, they said they also needed a waiver from the U.S. Embassy in Manila, apparently meaning a waiver from the U.S. government. All this double talk was clearly to fend off Tarsiana while the bank decided what to do next. That didn't take long. The solution was simple. Citibank would move all of Santee's assets offshore from Citibank New York to Cititrust in the Bahamas. This would have the effect of putting the bullion outside the jurisdiction of New York courts, blocking any lawsuits contemplated by the heirs. Legally, such assets could not be moved out of New York jurisdiction without authorization of the account holder or his heirs, or assigns, meaning Tarsiana as corporate treasurer. But if the gold were moved offshore without the knowledge of the account holder or his heirs, the burden would be upon them to recover it. Large shipments of gold bullion also cannot take place without the knowledge and approval of the U.S. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve. Nor could the bullion enter Nassau without approval of the Bahamian authorities. But there appear to have been ways to get around such obstacles, perhaps by attributing ownership of the gold to Citibank itself, which some attorneys might argue qualifies as wrongful conversion, unquote. This offshore maneuver was underway by the close of 1990 when word of it was leaked by a bank officer to members of the enterprise. And we're also going to take a look, and by the way, ultimately, Central Amana's heirs were totally unsuccessful. They all died poor. And we're also going to take a look here at the case of an Australian broker named Peter Johnston, who was trying to negotiate a UBS gold certificate in Europe. Now take a look at what happened to him. Again, turning to gold warriors, take the bizarre case of Australian broker Peter Johnston, who was asked by a client to negotiate a UBS gold certificate in Europe. While traveling, Johnston did not want to carry the certificate, so he left it in safe custody, unquote, with the London branch of Australia's Westpac Bank. He often lodged such certificates with Westpac. He did not ask Westpac to attest to its being genuine, yet the branch manager felt uneasy, unquote, and without asking Johnston, faxed copies to UBS in Switzerland asking if it was genuine. Without ever examining the original, UBS informally, unquote, declared it a forgery. It is UBS policy to call all such documents forgeries, but to avoid doing so formally by tested telex, because that is equivalent to sworn testimony in a court of law. An informal opinion casts doubt while avoiding liability. UBS does this routinely to scare away people hoping to negotiate gold certificates. Normally, the City of London Fraud Squad would refuse to pursue a charge based on an informal opinion, but this time, the fraud squad set up a sting, and when Johnston walked into the Westpac office on March 6th of 1995, he was arrested and charged with attempted fraud because the certificate might be phony and Johnston might try in the future to negotiate it. Amazingly, Johnston was convicted on this specious charge and languished in prison for 18 months. At no time did UBS actually establish that the certificate was a forgery, only saying it was not issued by UBS in Zurich. This was a blatant dodge because UBS gold bullion dealers are not done in Zurich but by their subsidiary Warburg Dillon Reed at Glottburg near Zurich Airport. In short, Johnston appears to have been falsely imprisoned on false testimony for something he did not attempt to do. There are many similarities to the Norbert Schley case. An expert on gold certificates, Wolfgang Jentsch, explains that these instruments, quote, may take many forms and quite possibly will not be in the banking form. They are, by their very nature, private banking documents and will not be in the public domain. The larger the amount concerned, the closer becomes the circle of those who know. It is rare that the main structure of the bank itself would ever know of their existence. The owner of the funds would be given a number of other documents in order to secure the certificate. He would be given a letter which would provide the details of only those persons who would be able to verify the existence of the certificates, and he would be given coded security numbers, unquote. Jentsch said coding typically includes, quote, what would appear to be severe spelling or grammatical errors, unquote. Such errors enable the bank, when it wishes, to denounce the certificate as counterfeit. We're going to conclude by taking a look at what happened with a retired Wall Street broker named Cotton Jones. In March of 1996, Filipino attorney Ben Aragones met retired Wall Street broker W.R. Cotton Jones. Aragones was a trustee of a big estate with bullion deposits in Switzerland. He told Cotton how he had been arrested by Swiss authorities for trying to negotiate a gold certificate, spent 3 months in jail, and was forbidden to return. On another trip to Zurich, he said he and his wife were kidnapped and terrorized. He was told that the UBS did this to scare him off forever. Cotton, being a romantic, offered to test the water by seeing if the New York branch of Swiss Bank Corporation would tell him whether one of Ben's certificates was real. Cotton would not try to negotiate the cert, which could be dangerous. If he only took a notarized photocopy, the original would not be confiscated. To be cautious, he chose the cert with the smallest denomination, only $25 million. On March 20th, 1996, he told us, "I walked into the Swiss Bank Corporation in New York and asked that the bank verify and authenticate a $25 million certificate of deposit issued by their bank and bearing the Federal Reserve seal. They asked him to leave it for examination and come back in 2 days. When he returned on March 22nd, three men posing as bank officers demanded the original and made threatening noises. When Cotton tried to snatch his photocopy back, all three men jumped up and identified themselves as U.S. Secret Service agents displaying badges and ID cards. They blocked his way and said if he forced the issue, he would be assaulting a federal agent. I kept denying and still deny that I ever knew whether the documents were valid or not. They told me I would be in jail for 22 years and that I'd better cooperate with them and it would go easier on me," unquote. After 90 minutes of bullying, Cotton was taken downtown and issued two U.S. District Court grand jury subpoenas in order to be in Secret Service agent Tom Atkinson's office at 10 a.m. on Monday. When Cotton appeared, he suffered more browbeating. Yet not once did anyone call the certificate false. He was told to appear before the grand jury the next day. So this is what happens, people. This is the way it works when people begin to attempt to penetrate or shed light into the darkness in the vault. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program 688, Darkness in the Vault, being recorded on September 6th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.